producing another Yes to Life show, looking into the world of integrative medicine for cancer, or integrative oncology as it's called. An approach that draws on the very best of both conventional and complementary medicine to extend care, improve quality of life, and of course, overall results. My guest this week was the keynote speaker at our enormously successful annual conference on the subject of cancer as a metabolic epigenetic disease, Travis Christofferson. Travis, through his writing, has become a leading light in the movement to rediscover the metabolic theory of cancer and to reconsider the ways in which cancer is best treated. I'm talking to Travis at his home in the splendidly named Rapid City in South Dakota. Hi, Travis. Brilliant to be talking to you again. It was great to meet you at our conference in November, and this is wonderful to be able to follow up.
Greetings. Wonderful to be here. Thank you, Robin.
So you've dedicated yourself the last few years to raising awareness of a completely different way of looking at and therefore of treating cancer. So why do you feel this is so important?
Well, I feel very strongly, very passionate about the basic science that that leads us to believe that cancer is metabolic in origin. And that when you look at cancer from a therapeutic standpoint, right, I mean, we're always looking for targets. And anytime you target a disease, you're trying to differentiate between normal tissue and disease tissue. And so this is extremely important, especially in cancer, because there is such an overlap between a cancer cell and a normal cell. It's difficult to target. And we've been under the impression now for over 50 years that the way to approach cancer therapies is to target the mutational derivatives of the cancer cell. And this is based on what's called the somatic mutation theory of cancer, that what's driving cancer are mutations to the cancer genome. And we now know that, I mean, it's safe to say, and I'm not the only one, that this approach has been a dismal failure. And we thought this would lead to cures, you know, from the mid 70s when it first was established, we thought we'd have cures within a decade. And well over 700 targeted drugs have been developed to date, and it hasn't moved the needle on cancer death rates. Cancer death rates have remained stagnant since the 50s. So there's many oncologists, many basic scientists that are rethinking this approach as a way to tackle cancer through targeted therapy. And going back to the days of Otto Warburg and this metabolic approach where we target the metabolism of cancer, which is a wonderful target. It's been around, you know, been known since the 20s. That cancer cells have this defective metabolism that's this beautiful target. And now we're starting to learn how to exploit it and seeing some real progress.
Mm. Okay, so your book, Tripping Over the Truth, has been out for something like 2.5 years, I think, now. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. It came out in October of 2014.
Mm. So it's been pretty successful. And one of the keys to the success, I'd say, is accessibility. It's a science book, but it is in plain English. It's what a book I like to read. And so what made you decide not to write a science book for scientists, because this is a science subject, but to aim it squarely at the public?
You know, for me, the science book was already written. It came out in 2012 by Tom Seyfried, and it's called Cancer as a Metabolic Disease. And Tom, I give Tom, you know, he's kind of the godfather of this whole movement. Mm. I give him credit for really reviving Warburg's original theory that cancer is metabolic in origin. And so Tom had, you know, written this comprehensive textbook type format that looks over 100 years of cancer research and compiled all the evidence that points towards this metabolic origin of cancer. So I was dumbfounded by this book when I read it, that this much evidence existed that refuted the somatic mutation theory and supported Warburg's original theory. So the science book was sitting there in plain sight. To me, the challenge was to take that and to give it to the general public. And it was, you know, it was made much easier for me because it was such a beautiful narrative, because it began with this brilliant German scientist, Otto Warburg, who claimed cancer was metabolic in origin back in the 20s. And, you know, back then, Warburg's reputation was stellar. He was one of the handful of the great biochemists of the day. And if you don't know his history, he volunteered for World War I and was so respected that Albert Einstein wrote him a letter urging him to come back, that humanity was much better served by him in the laboratory than off fighting a war. So he did come back, and he turned his focus to cancer. And that's when he noticed this sort of striking metabolic abnormality of the cancer cell. So it began with that, and then Warburg, if you fast forward through the 20th century, his theory became ridiculed as this overly simplistic view of cancer and was cast aside. And it was really kind of the scar in his entire career. Mm. When he died in 1970, he was kind of ridiculed for this theory of cancer. And so it was this beautiful, you know, narrative of a redemption story of Otto Warburg and you know, kind of this exciting new light that we're looking at the cancer cell in through the metabolic lens. So it was an easy story because it was right there as far as the drama goes. But trying to get it, you know, the hard part for me was trying to the actual writing to get it to the layperson. It's a difficult task, but that was my goal.
Mm. Wow, you pulled it off. It's brilliant. So I'm going to ask you, this is a tall order, but you're the man for the job. If anybody can do it, can you outline briefly the key differences between the generally accepted view of cancer, what it is, and the metabolic view that your book introduces?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the key view of cancer today, which is changing as we speak, you know, it's very, when you look at how theories rise and fall, they don't change overnight. They change over long periods of time. So this it's called the somatic mutation theory of cancer, and that's the dogmatic theory of cancer now as we speak, which is that cancer arises from key mutations to the genes that control the cell cycle. And the cell cycle is just how a cell divides. So when you get key mutations to these genes, you unleash what's called replicative immortality. So the cell just divides. And that's the hallmark pathological feature of the cancer cell, is uncontrolled cellular division. So we notice that, you know, the things that cause cancer are the same thing that mutate nuclear DNA, which are carcinogens, radiation, viruses, all these things. So it was easy to make the link at the middle of the century between these causes of cancer and the mutations within the cancer cell. And so that sent us off and running to the races that, you know, what we'd find these mutations and cure cancer. Now, the difference is the metabolic theory of cancer states that cancer starts from damage to what's called the mitochondria. These are the little organelles within the cell that generate energy, and they generate energy for the cell using oxygen. So what happens is when enough of these organelles are damaged, and the same things that damage nuclear DNA damage mitochondria, radiation, viruses, carcinogens, and so forth. So when there's a threshold level of mitochondrial damage, the cell will begin to revert to this sort of ancient method of energy creation called fermentation. And the cell will take sugar and consume sugar voraciously through this pathway called glycolysis, which generates a little bit of energy, but then it generates a waste product called lactic acid. So that's what Warburg noticed when he turned to the cancer cell. He noticed that cancer cells were generating tremendous amounts of lactic acid in the presence of oxygen. And this is something normal, healthy cells will typically never do. So the question was, why are they doing that? Of course, Warburg didn't have the tools to notice how damaged the mitochondria were, but he suspected they were. And that was, you know, the prime basis of his theory, that there was damage to what he called the grana, and because they were the granular substances that were later called mitochondria. And he determined this was the prime cause of cancer: injury to the cell's ability to respire. And respiration is just another word for energy generation using oxygen in the mitochondria, and a reversion to fermentation, or the generation of lactic acid. And now he could never draw a line between this metabolic defect in the cancer cell and uncontrolled proliferation. And this was why he was really ridiculed. And this is where Tom Seyfried stepped in. The research that had accumulated showed that the mitochondria will send what's called an epigenetic signal. It's called the retrograde response. And this signal goes to the nucleus and tells key genes to be upregulated. And now we know these genes that are upregulated are responsible for driving the Warburg effect and driving all six hallmark features of cancer: uncontrolled proliferation, you know, invasiveness, all these things, evading the immune system, metastasis, and so forth. So that is, in a nutshell, that's the comprehensive metabolic theory and versus the comprehensive somatic mutation theory of cancer.
Interesting. So that's very interesting about that, sending the signals to the nucleus to upregulate all these key things, which are, as you say, they're the hallmarks of cancer. They're the things that cancer does that ordinary cells would never do. So basically, you've taken an ordinary cell, it was behaving very nicely, and you sent it some messages, okay, now it's time to go berserk.
That's right. That's right. And all those genes are right there. You know, that's the key feature. The difference is that cancer appears under the somatic mutation theory. You have to believe cancer is a product of chaos, product of damage. That every time you receive these different series of mutations, you get the same outcome, which is pathological growth, invasiveness, all these deterministic, you know, systematic things that cancer does.
Yes.
Whereas the metabolic view says that you're tripping this epigenetic program, which is the exact same, virtually the same every time, which results in the same disease every time. So yeah, it's two different, pretty dramatically different views of what cancer is.
Certainly. Okay, and just to summarize, what you were talking about to do with the differences between a cancerous cell and a healthy cell with its energy production. It was characterized, there were two words that are kind of ones that we would normally understand. Well, one was respiration and the other one was fermentation. That would pretty much characterize the difference in the way they were actually building their energy. Is that right?
That's correct. And so when you look at the cancer cell, one of the more striking features, and this work was done in Peter Peterson's lab at Johns Hopkins, is that, and he really picked right up where Warburg left off. He was doing this work in the 70s, right after Warburg died. What he noticed is the more aggressive the cancer cell is, actually the less mitochondria they have. So these very aggressive cancers will have about 50% of the normal content of mitochondria as a normal cell. And so they're ripping through glycolysis, through fermentation, and they have, in the mitochondria they do have, are typically really morphologically damaged. Morphological is just a fancy word for the structure. And you see all these defects in proteins and fats in the mitochondria. So their structure is really damaged. And so, and Peterson determined that cancer cells typically will generate the majority of their energy through glycolysis, through fermentation, about 60 to 70%, and about 40 to 30% is generated through respiration. Now, normal cells will generate about 90% through respiration and about only 10% through, not even through fermentation, but just through glycolysis, which feeds into oxidative phosphorylation. So very, very, you know, different ways of generating energy.
So it's the balance has changed, basically. The cancer cell is still using respiration, but far, far less, and it's relying the majority on fermentation.
Right, and the crux of that debate has always been why. And so the somatic mutation guys will say, well, they're doing it because they prefer glycolysis for not reasons of energy compensation, whereas the metabolic guys are saying, well, they're doing it because they have to because the mitochondria are damaged.
Right. Okay, so you've already alluded to the fact that the enormous investment of time and money in the Cancer Genome Atlas and all the things that have happened to pursue the somatic theory and its consequent methods of treatment as largely a failure. Well, can you describe exactly what it did show us and how the results differed from the expectations?
Yeah, right. So the Cancer Genome Atlas, for those who don't know, was a massive government project that began in 2006 to sequence the genomes of cancer cells. And so before we'd find mutations, but we never knew exactly how many mutations there were in any type of cancer. So this goal of this project was to find every mutation in each type of cancer. And so this kicked off in 2006, and sequencing technology got so good during the span of that project that it even got expanded while the project was going on. They sequenced way more cancer genomes than they originally intended to. And so in the end, they ended up sequencing 10,000 samples. And they found what they expected to find was determined in the 1990s when clinicians looked at cancer. They noticed it didn't just appear, right? The cancer went through this graded series of steps. For example, cervical cancer went through a series of steps before it became a full-blown malignancy. And same with colon cancer, went through polyps and these certain defined stages before it became a frank neoplasm. And the research looked like each one of these stages was underpinned by a specific genetic lesion. So the idea was that we'd have this molecular signature of mutations for each type of cancer that would define it. So that's sort of what they expected to see, something that made sense, right? Some tidy organization of mutations for each type of cancer. But right away, when the project kicked off 2007, when the data started coming in, what they found out was it looked nothing like this. From one sample to the next, this is called intertumoral heterogeneity, and it's just a quantification of the difference in the mutations from one sample to the next. It was incredible. There was so many differing mutations from one sample to the next. There was very few commonly mutated genes. The molecular signature wasn't there. They found samples with single driving mutations. They found samples with none. So the idea that cancer was this exclusive genetic disease was really just tossed out the window. There had to be some other presumptive force that was driving the disease. And this was, again, you know, this was supposed to be our last stand with cancer. We'd find every mutation responsible for every type, and cures would follow. But it's left us this wake of sort of chaos, and nobody near enough trying to develop therapies from this data. Now they're just trying to correlate clinical outcomes from this data. So, for example, if you have this mutation, these chemotherapies should respond better for you. So, you know, nobody and Spouse is giving more money to this project because they have this massive repository of data now. And it's so large that most institutions can't even access it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's left a lot of confusion. It certainly didn't lead to what we thought it would.
Mm. So it's interesting, you know, it's almost like you're looking at the same thing from two different ends. If you look at it, they've been looking at it from the gene end, and they hoped to find something simple there, a nice, neat pattern that was going to show them how to go forward. But in fact, looking at it from a metabolic end, you have got a simple start. And because it's going through millions of different complex organisms and different parts of the same organism, the same body, the results are all over the place. Of course, they're very complex, and then they don't relate to each other. You know, you've had a simple start, but then every person is different, every part of that person is different, and therefore what actually happens to those cells and how they mutate inevitably would be a very disparate picture.
Well said. And so that leaves you with just lack of targets. I mean, it's hard enough to find one mutation from one person's tumor to the next.
Right.
And then there's another degree of chaos within the tumor called intratumoral heterogeneity.
Right.
And as the sequencing technology got better, this thing called deep sequencing came online, where you could actually tease out the mutations from cell to cell within the same tumor. And what they found out was there's even a large degree of difference from cell to cell. Mm. So from a targeted therapeutic standpoint, you can target one mutation, but another cell may render that target ineffectual within the same tumor.
Right. So, yes, so you can well appreciate why some people are calling this an unqualified failure. As I mentioned at the start, the most important thing about this different view of what cancer actually is, what causes it, is that it leads to very different approaches to treatment. So would you like to just talk a bit more generally now about how these two different approaches to treatment would look?
Yeah. Well, as I said before, the targeted therapies have been a utter disappointment. They haven't really moved the needle on death rates. Most of these drugs that get developed, you know, they target one molecular pathway. Everybody knows we'll never get anywhere that way with cancer. We're going to have to target this thing from multiple angles. So that approach has been a failure, hasn't moved the needle. One exception to that is a molecule called Gleevec, which can treat CML leukemia. And it targets that's one of the few cancers that has a homogeneous mutational profile. Now it's able to be targeted that way. And even Gleevec is not clear, because Gleevec is what targets a kinase, and it also targets the metabolism of the cancer cell. When you use Gleevec, the cancer cell reverts back to normal oxidative metabolism. Mm. So even Gleevec, it's not clear how it's working. But beyond Gleevec, most of these, you know, they cost north of $100,000 because the pharmaceutical company has to shepherd these from phase one through phase three, and it costs close to $1 billion. So to recoup that cost, you know, they charge north of $100,000, and these drugs might give you a month survival if you're lucky, some not even that. So metabolic drugs, you know, they target the simple, this one metabolic defect. And the interesting thing about these drugs, or even the ketogenic diet, which is a metabolic therapy, is they target multiple pathways at the same time. Like a pharmaceutical company will develop a drug for something called IGF-1, which has been shown to promote and fuel cancer. And so they'll blanket the receptor with a drug. And they did this, and it was shown not to work. And the ketogenic diet does this extremely well, and it's free. You can bring IGF levels down to virtually imperceptible levels. But these are just getting started, these metabolic therapies. We are finally getting a glimpse of some data about their efficacy. And we had talked earlier about this young doctor in Istanbul that is using, he became enthusiastic about this approach early on, and he's using these metabolic therapies and getting statistically significant data. And he's able to do this in Turkey because it's a much more permissive regulatory environment. Stage four cancer patients, the doctors are given sort of this carte blanche to do what they feel is right without worry, you know, getting sued like in the UK and the US. Mm-hmm. So he's using this, what he calls metabolically supported chemotherapy. And they still have to use chemotherapy, but they can use it on the low end of the dose range. And so what he does is he puts his patients on a ketogenic diet. And for those of you who don't know the ketogenic diet, your listeners probably do know what it is, I assume, right, Robin?
Well, no, let's not assume anything, okay? Just give us the basics, yeah?
Ketogenic diet, very simply, it's a high-fat, low-carbohydrate or no-carbohydrate diet. And so when you go on this diet, you shift away from glucose metabolism towards fat metabolism, and you replace, to some degree, circulating blood sugar with these molecules called ketone bodies. Now, the interesting thing about this diet from a cancer perspective is ketone bodies have to be burned oxidatively in intact functioning mitochondria, whereas glucose, as we talked about earlier, can be burned by the cancer cell through fermentation. So we shift our metabolism towards this environment that's conducive to respiration and very hard for a cancer cell to exist in. So what he's doing, he puts his patients on this ketogenic diet. He has them do at least a 14-hour fast before chemotherapy for a variety of reasons. They do the low-dose chemotherapy. Then they do what's called 2-deoxyglucose, which is a glycolytic inhibitor. It's a small molecule drug that inhibits the fermentation pathway. So you restrict the cancer cells' access to sugar even further. Then he adds in DCA, which is another small molecule that has been shown to increase apoptosis, which is just cell death. Then he does extensive hyperbaric oxygen, which is another very intriguing metabolic therapy that acts in synergy with the ketogenic diet. It acts sort of like radiation in that it increases what's called ROS, or reactive oxygen species, which are very toxic to the cancer cell. But it's a much kinder, you know, gentler approach than radiation. And these are therapies that Tom Seyfried, you know, has been studying for a long time, and he showed the efficacy in his book back in 2012. So using this approach, this metabolically supported chemotherapy, he's able to take pancreatic patients, this is his first trial, from a median survival of 11 months to over 20 months. So he doubled survival time. 1 year survival, I think, went from 20 months to 80 months, something like that. Then his last study he did on lung cancer was even more, the results were just eye-popping. He brought median survival from standard care, which is 8.6 months, up to 43 months. Wow. And that's still climbing because many patients are still alive. So over a 400% increase.
Yeah.
Just adding on these metabolic approaches. Now, the thing about this that's so difficult is these can't get funding because nobody can patent these approaches. So you cannot shepherd them through this process to get approval in the US, which is a phase 3 placebo-controlled double-blind study.
So we need a completely new route. On these.
Yeah, we need these brave, bold doctors like Dr. Slocum, who realized early on the only way You know, there's all kinds of alternative medicine out there, but it's not proven. Only way to move these forward is to actually do the studies and prove that this works and show everybody, you know, and then go from there. And what now this opens up a new debate is what should the burden of proof be before we adopt these to standard of care? Should it be a massive multi-institutional phase 3 trial? Or should we just be able to show, you know, phase 1-2 data with objective survival times that are way increased and that's enough? You know, that's a whole other debate we need to have.
Well, I mean, when you're dealing with stage 4 patients with a very poor prognosis and you're doing a treatment which is essentially non-toxic and is it might not do them any good, but it's almost certain not to do them any harm. There's that you don't need that much burden of proof. If you're a patient, that's good enough for me. I mean, I'd be doing it, you know, just like that. You know, it's a highly toxic drug, then sure, you need the evidence. But this is a lot different, really, isn't it?
Right. I mean, you added in the next variable in that equation, which is risk-reward ratio.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
The risk is shown to be non-existent. So, yeah.
Interesting. So, yeah, we need to move the bar, if you like, for this kind of approach. So it's totally inappropriate to be expecting non-harmful approaches to meet the same standards of evidence as things that are known to be harmful.
Yeah, and I don't know what it, you know, we sort of have an example from the AIDS community about how this should go forward. The AIDS community was very organized back in the 80s. As they were, you know, tackling this devastating disease. And they knew right away that with a terminal illness, these placebo double-blind studies just, they're not designed with terminal illness in mind, I guess is the right way to say it. So they really advocated for doctors to take bold, you know, take risks. And that's how this cocktail approach, how we manage AIDS today, never went through a phase 3 trial. It was, you know, by bold doctors and patients protesting Congress and so forth. They pushed this cocktail approach, and that's what's being prescribed today. Mm. So I think we need the same sort of groundswell in cancer therapies. To move.
Well, I could see it happening. I mean, you know, they did all that without the aid of social media. We've got social media now, and, kind of Facebook groups and things that are beavering away behind the scenes, being very active, helping each other out on this kind of front, could be quite a force if they started joining up together.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we see it. I mean, we see, when I started this in 2013, and every year it's grown. And the Tampa conference we were just talking about, it's the Metabolic Therapeutics Conference. Last year was 150. This year was almost 500. And, you know, so every year you see that this is growing. And I think you're absolutely right. Social media, the internet has changed everything.
Great. Now, can I just backstep onto one thing that seemed like it's a key thing that this applies really however you're looking at cancer, is that industry as a whole has always tended to take these kind of monotherapeutic approach where they get one target, one drug, and it's going to work on this one target. Whether that happens to be chemotherapy or whether it happens to be a targeted drug, doesn't matter what it is, they're always looking at it in that way. And you've just described AIDS there. You see, AIDS, they didn't do that. They actually, the public pushed for something different, and that's what works, and they're doing it. So you've very much described how in cancer, the kind of approaches that people are taking as a result of the metabolic view, but also generally, people who are doing integrative medicine are using chemotherapy as well. They're using it as one of the things they do. They're actually always targeting cancer from a lot of different angles, and this seems to be such a key part of any successful therapy.
Absolutely. That you know, every oncologist I've talked to in the last 3-4 years has said the exact same thing. The only way we're going to solve this disease is through a cocktail approach, through combinations of therapies. And just to give you an example, where you talked about how pharmaceutical companies will focus on one monotherapy, one pathway, and they do this, you know, it's their incentive structure is so that they don't want to take a big risk, because as we said, it costs up to $1 billion to bring a drug all the way to market. So they just are incentivized to do these tiny incremental improvements in drugs. So they're never really looking for cures. They're always trying to de-risk the development of a new drug, which results in a very marginal, if any, efficacy.
Right.
So just another example is the ketogenic diet. Now, we know that it's a very seductive cancer therapy in the fact that everybody can understand that cancer loves sugar. And that's when you look at a PET scan, that's what you're looking at is cancer's voracious appetite for sugar. The ketogenic diet shifts away from this metabolism, but it's also operating on another level. Adrian Scheck's work has shown that epigenetically, when you look at like 12 different very important transcription factors in cancer, like HIF-1 alpha, tumor necrosis factor, a dozen of these things are significantly reduced by the ketogenic diet. Now, a pharmaceutical company would be happy to pay $800 million just to target one of those pathways. So you see this misalignment between big pharma and what a good cancer therapy should be. Now, we know that the ketogenic diet can probably slow cancer growth. Will that result in cures? Probably not. But it looks like its strong suit is the way it differentially prepares, affects cancer cells and normal cells. So it makes normal cells more healthy for a variety of biochemical reasons we probably can't get into. And it weakens cancer cells. It reduces their capacity to manufacture antioxidants. It reduces their energy supply. So it potentiates them to die through other therapies. So when you, like Dr. Slocum is doing, when you do the ketogenic diet and then put chemo on top of that or hyperbaric oxygen, you see this massive killing of cancer cells. And a much more orderly killing. They go through apoptosis. There's less inflammation within the microenvironment. So, you know, that's just one example. Another example is pharmaceutical companies are developing, they're called histone deacetylase inhibitors. And they have already got one approved by the FDA for cancer. And this drug is now in 80 different trials. Now, beta hydroxybutyrate, which is the main ketone body produced by the ketogenic diet, is also a histone deacetylase inhibitor, and it's probably just as good, if not better. But it's not in these trials; it's free. So that's the catch-22: is these therapies that are absolutely wonderful do not get any backing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So don't be expecting business to come up with any cures soon. That's a message.
Right.
Yeah, and I was very interested in one thing you were saying there about, say, the ketogenic diet, for example, is that, of course, if you're looking at any kind of conventional treatment, they have the same idea. Of course, they're trying to pick out the cancer cells, select them out from the healthy cells and kill them off. But it's only a negative effect on that side. That's what they're trying to do. And the result is they have a negative effect on cancer cells, and usually they have a negative effect on the rest of them at the same time. Whereas the ketogenic diet, you're saying, actually gives a positive effect to healthy cells at the same time as a negative effect on cancer cells. I mean, that's quite a sort of a double whammy.
Yeah, it's the holy grail of targeted therapies. Because you're lucky if you get one that just leaves normal cells alone. But the ketogenic diet actually... We're finding it sounds like snake oil because it can treat so many different pathological conditions, but there's so many pathological states that spin out of an inability to use sugar properly, from type 2 diabetes to Alzheimer's, which are calling type 3 diabetes. And the ketogenic diet circumvents that metabolism and goes straight to respiration. So when it does this, it makes normal cells more robust. Their antioxidant profile goes up. You have a majorly decrease in free radicals come out of the electron transport chain. The cells are packed with ATP. They become more energized. You get this myriad of beneficial effects, which is unheard of in therapies, in addition to selectively targeting cancer cells. Now, and this has been shown. Walter Longo did a small trial where he had cancer patients do a fast, a really long fast, up to, I think, a 150-hour fast before chemotherapy. From a 48-hour fast to 150-hour fast before they got chemotherapy. And so fasting, of course, is the quickest way to enter what we call ketosis, generate ketone bodies. And what they found was the 14 most common side effects from chemotherapy were hugely diminished, and the objective ones that you can measure. So, for example, the vomiting that comes with chemotherapy, you know, the worst, one of the most debilitating side effects was brought down to zero. The patients who fasted did not vomit at all. They also had no diarrhea, whereas the patients who didn't fast, you know, were, of course, were stricken with daily vomiting and diarrhea. Everything was diminished, from mouth sores to dizziness to fatigue. So that's just a, you know, very dramatic example of how this elegant theory translates into the clinical environment.
So that, if you like, is a bonus on top of the fact that actually the chemotherapy is going to work better as well. So less side effects and more effective.
Exactly. Mm. Right.
Amazing. All right. So when we invited you to be our keynote speaker at our annual conference last year, you actually asked that we change the title of the conference from Cancer as a Metabolic Disease to Cancer as a Metabolic Epigenetic Disease. Now, I've used that word once before in the show already, and this, I believe, reflected your developing view of cancer. Can you tell us a bit about this, starting by explaining the difference between genetic and epigenetic?
Sure. So that's kind of the buzzword these days, epigenetics. So
yeah.
Epigenetics is very simple. It's genetics. Classic genetics is the study of the code of the written, you know, script of life within your DNA. So it's the actual code that you can't change. You inherit your DNA and that's it. And epigenetics is simply, without changing the code, the turning on and the turning off of genes. So we all inherit 20,000 genes, and they get differentially expressed within tissue type. So for example, your neurons will never express a gene for digestive enzymes, which would probably be a bad thing. So within different tissue types, certain genes get turned on and turned off. Now, what we're finding now, epigenetics is an extremely hot field of study, that these changes are happening way more dynamically than we ever thought. They happen from the level of transcription factors to the actual modification of DNA itself. You know, just one example, if you walk outside in a sunny day, you manufacture vitamin D. Vitamin D then binds to a receptor in your nucleus, which binds to what's called vitamin D response elements. And this flickers on about over 900 genes.
Wow.
that affect everything from calcium absorption to innate immunity. They turn on the gene that transfers a tryptophan to serotonin. So that's why your mood elevates when you're in the sun.
Mm.
So these changes are happening way more dynamically. And now we're even finding out that epigenetic changes have this sort of solidifying effect that can be even inherited. So perhaps one of the, you know, reasons why lung cancer rates haven't dropped as much as we thought they would after smoking has decreased so much is because we're actually inheriting the epigenetic
Wow.
changes of our parents that smoked.
Wow.
So these things are incredibly important. And how this translates into cancer, you know, is Paul Davies really has brought this to light, that there's sort of two programs embedded in our DNA. One of them is the program of epigenetics. So we all begin as a single cell, a fertilized egg. Then we go through this cascading series of transcription factors and epigenetic changes that results in building a mature organism. Now, this is all done through epigenetics, through a program, embryogenesis. And then typically, as we're adults, a lot of these fetal genes, these genes expressed early on, get turned off. Now, when you look at the cancer cell, what's very interesting is many of these fetal genes that are involved in the process of embryogenesis get turned back on. So it looks like cancer is a reawakening of the program of embryogenesis just within an out-of-context format. And to give you just one very, you know, kind of dramatic example of this, we all have four copies of a gene called hexokinase 2. Now, hexokinase 2 catalyzes the first step of glycolysis or fermentation. It takes glucose and turns it into glucose 6-phosphate, which is one of 10 steps on the way to lactic acid, right? So as adults, we express what's called hexokinase 1. and we express a tiny bit of hexokinase too. These are all the same gene. They're just slightly different. So in my book, I use the example of they're like tires. You have snow tires, you have street tires. They all serve the same function. They're just slightly different. So hexokinase 1 is what we express as adults, but the cancer cell will revert to hexokinase 2 and then dramatically overexpress this gene. Now, this is extremely relevant because hexokinase 2 is not subject to the same controls as hexokinase 1. Hexokinase 1, when a certain level of glucose-6-phosphate gets built up, will shut itself down. Hexokinase 2 does not. So it just shoves glucose down this pathway, which is the Warburg effect. So this is one shift from a gene, a normal gene, to a fetal gene. By the way, hexokinase 2 is expressed in embryogenesis. So it's, again, it's awakening of these fetal genes that is responsible for a hallmark feature of cancer. And now Peterson's lab at Johns Hopkins also showed that hexokinase 2 does something incredible. It goes to the mitochondria and binds to this channel called the VDAC channel, which is voltage-dependent anion channel, which is a little pore that allows the cell to commit apoptosis. So we know that one of the more devastating hallmark features of the cancer cell is that it becomes immortal. It's unable to be killed. So this switch to this one enzyme within our bodies, this epigenetic switch, is responsible for two hallmark features of cancer. And no mutations required, right? Mm-hmm. So we're just beginning to learn how important these epigenetic changes are to cancer.
Mm. Right. Yeah, it's a complex business, and it just says reams about our relationship to our environment, doesn't it? About the fact that we're not kind of separate items moving around. We're actually interacting with our environment all the time in so many ways.
Much more than we thought before, yeah. Mm. Yeah, we're very flexible and subject to change.
Interesting. Okay, so I'm wondering whether you've got reason to think that the metabolic view is gaining ground since you first put your book out, and whether you're hopeful that one day soon it's going to be the prevalent theory on which all cancer treatment is based.
Yeah, it's gaining ground without a doubt. And that, I think, a good example of that is the New York Times article in May of last year by Sam Apple about Warburg and about this idea of starving cancer to death. So in the New York Times, of course, is very careful to not print anything that's not kind of mainstream. They don't like to do alternative things. So it's definitely circled back into the mainstream. When you read reviews on cancer, the genetic theory is not completely disposed of, but it's certainly been modified. Researchers almost inevitably bring up the epigenetic component of cancer now when they in the reviews, and how this may be the dominant feature of cancer. So it's changing, but again, it's not like one person comes out and says, hey, cancer's metabolic. It's just this slow, subtle shift that you kind of imperceptible almost, but it's definitely happening.
Unfortunately, that's got an awful lot to do with not losing too much face, I think, within science. People actually not willing to say I was wrong.
That's right. When you have careers invested in this theory and you've written hundreds of papers on it, and your money train is still there's still all these sequencing machines out there that require grants. So, you just can't, it's impossible to admit it because you wouldn't have a paycheck the next day.
Unfortunately, if you measure the cost of that adherence, that pride, if you like, in lives, it's tragic. The results of not being prepared to move with the new discoveries is, it's massive in terms of suffering.
Right. That's true.
Okay. Well, look, key reason for talking to you today, apart from the fact that I really love it, is that you've just released a new edition of Tripping Over the Truth with a new publisher, and I think it's already available in the UK. It's a little bit up on your last edition. Do you want to tell us a bit about it?
So I got picked up by a publisher, Chelsea Green, and they, spruced it up where it really needed sprucing. And we added an index, another round of editing. We have a wonderful foreword written by Dominic D'Agostino, who's a pioneer in many of these metabolic studies that we're talking about, especially ketone metabolism. You know, Dominic's a wonderful scientist, wonderful person. And then we added an epilogue, which was just sort of an update about many of the things that you and I have talked about today, Robin. Many of these problems with the regulatory environment, where this risk-reward ratio should be, what the burden of proof should be for these metabolic therapies that we're talking about. And then I talked about Dr. Slocum's results, you know, that he's actually showing clinically significant data that we can point to now. And that's what, you know, that's what clinicians need to see. If they're going to change or bolt anything onto standard of care, they have to have something to back that up. So I'm so glad that he is, you know, taking it in his own hands to do that kind of work. So we talk about that in the epilogue and just sort of an update on 3-bromopyruvate, where it's at and things like that.
Mm, great. I must say, I'm very heartened to hear the beginnings of looking at what is called real world data in the UK. I don't know if that's something that's happening over your side of the pond as well, but you know, that we have our National Health Service, which actually, of course, well, they've got the most massive real world trial ever going on all the time, and they've got the data, but they just don't simply put it together and say, well, you know, the drugs company said this does this, but actually we found out it does this. You know, they could do that so easily, but they've never done it. And but is beginning to be pressure for it to happen. And the day that real world data takes prevalence over business driven trials that companies put out will be a great day for us all.
Yeah, indeed. And we have the power now, you're right, because of the internet. We have new ways, you know, creative ways that we can capture data from all these anecdotal cases that we see day to day. We can capture those and bring them into a database.
Yes.
There's a lot of talk about that at the Tamper Conference. And that's, it's changing. The regulatory environment in the U.S. is changing. Muscular dystrophy just got a drug approved after only being in 12 patients. So that's a first. The FDA, of course, was, you know, very internally, there was a very heated debate about whether to do it, but they tilted towards a side of, in my view, a patient-centric side, because the patients and the parents of these kids were really the ones that demanded this drug.
Mm.
So they took a more rational viewpoint that, you know, the risk reward versus what they have for options now, and they actually approved this drug after only being in 12 patients.
Mm.
So I think there is a shift.
Good. And I think you're right that the power of the internet to bring together a, you know, myriad of small trial results from around the planet and centralize them in one place, therefore to produce a good burden of evidence, is, I mean, that has to be the way things go, I think. I mean, that, especially when we have this cost issue with trialing non-profitable drugs. I mean, that's the way it can happen, of course.
Yeah, and it's this is where government should step in. This is what, right, what government's for.
Absolutely.
Things that would have a massive society, but will never get funded because of the way the market system is set up.
Mm.
And yeah. You know, the market, medicine doesn't really operate under free market rules anyway, because, you know, when's the last time somebody price shopped for brain surgery?
Mm.
You have people at their most vulnerable.
Yes.
And so it's not, this is where we need government, is to help out in these kind of things.
Mm. Well, government, of course, could set up the kind of frameworks you need in order for evidence to be gathered from a mass of small sources. That would be a marvelous thing for government to do. You know, it can produce all the criteria and all the oversight. And whereas the results might not be as controlled as they would be in a clinical trial, nonetheless, you could, the overwhelming amount of data you could have would make it significant.
Right, exactly.
Mm. Okay, well, look, fascinating to talk to you, Travis. Really enjoyed it. Very interesting. Looking forward to looking at the new book and all the extras in it. And I hope it's enormously successful, changes lots of minds and hearts. And looking forward to the next time we can have you over here in the UK as well. So thanks a lot for talking to me today.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure, Robin. Take care.
Well, if you found that interesting, be sure to check out the video of the talk that Travis gave at our annual conference, which you can download for a mere £7 from thecancerrevolution.co.uk. That's thecancerrevolution.co.uk. Choose Video Shop from the top bar. And while you're there, check out the other brilliant talks from Paul Davies, Rob Verkirk, Ndaba Matsubuko, Patricia Daly and Jane McClelland. Another quick reminder about upcoming Yes to Life events. In Brighton on the 11th of March, there is an Outsmart Cancer Cookery Workshop with the dynamic duo Jenny and Geraldine of Inspired Nutrition. On the 22nd of March in Shoreditch, a Nourishing Movement Workshop with Liz Butler and Lizzie Davis. And on the 30th of March near Oxford, there's a Mindfulness Workshop with the brilliant Claire McCluskey. Lastly, the next in our series of Lifestyle Choices in Cancer will be in Manchester on April the 1st. Details of all our events are on the Yes to Life website, that's yestolife.org.uk. In next week's show, I shall be talking to Charlotte Crowell, an inspirational young woman with a grueling personal story to tell, as well as a passion for helping through her brilliantly named organisation, Pure Helps to Cure. Goodbye.